order.
Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. We normally do this, council rules and ethics, when we do the council candidate orientation, and we didn't do that this year, so we've decided to do it after the election. And so, Nancy, would you do us the honors?
Actually, I think we decided, was it last year or the year before, that we wanted an ethics review after the election also.
So you're going to get double dose. You can have triple dose if you want it. I'm going to try to get through this as quick as I can, but there's a lot of information between council rules, ethics, and conflict of interest. I did provide all the council members with kind of the summary of the slides at your place with the notes taking if you so desire to take notes. I noticed after the fact that there were a couple of things that are out of place, but we're just going to take it as it rolls. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to stop me as we go along. I start off really with a introductory slide about, oh, that didn't do it, not that one. There we go. You don't really care about Calvin and Hobbes other than if you know anything about Calvin and Hobbes, they are amidst ethical dilemmas from time to time. And in this particular one, I think there was a discussion about whether or not it was appropriate to cheat, and they ran out of time before they actually made a decision. So, not unlike government sometimes. okay, so just the general overview that I think is always important to remind people is that when you talk with your peers or your elected peers, the type of city that you are really depends upon the powers that the city has. And so cities derive their powers from the Constitution of the State and the General Assembly. We are a charter city, however, so we have kind of superpowers. We have the power of any city in the state of Missouri as long as it's not contrary to the Constitution or expressly prohibited. And we write our own rules. So I like to say that our Bible or our local constitution is our charter. I have a really well-worn charter because it is, I reference it, I've read it probably 300 times, and every single time I pulled it out of my office today when somebody came in to ask a question and said, well, let's just make sure exactly what that says. Because this is what our voters have approved, and it's what the people of Columbia have said is going to be the form of government. So we start with the charter and the preamble. The preamble really is illustrative to me of what the citizens of Columbia have established as a form of government. It's the, as you read through it, it's a democratic form of government. The basic structure is a city manager form of city administration. The preamble mentions full publicity and openness in the conduct of city government, public meetings, and records, which is really unusual to have in your preamble to a charter, but it's certainly an issue that's strong and important to the citizens of Columbia. And then to provide for equality of citizenship for all Columbians, to promote the common welfare, and establish the Home Rule Charter. So that's the groundwork for which all of our work is done. So the city manager form of government combines that strong political leadership of elected officials with the managerial experience of an appointed city manager. The city manager is one of three employees appointed by the city council. He is appointed on a nonpartisan basis under the rules established in the charter. And I say he because we currently have a male. Obviously, it doesn't have to be a male. It could be a female. But in this instance, your city manager was appointed on a nonpartisan professional basis. The role of the city manager is to submit an annual statement of policy recommendations with the priorities for the city. Budget preparation, provides annual financial reports. He's the chief advisor to the council. City manager may engage in debate but has no vote. The city manager works in partnership with the council to develop the approaches to community challenges and assists in long-term development of a vision. It's the role of the city manager to implement the administrative responsibilities within the mission and goals established by the city council. and to enforce all laws and ordinances. So when it comes to the council, the role of the council is to focus on community goals, major projects, community growth, land use development, capital improvement and financing, and strategic planning. All of those day-to-day administrative functions are left to your city manager. The mayor is elected at large, but he's a voting member of the council. The mayor, it's important to recognize the difference, because in some cities, your mayor will actually be the administrative head, or the mayor may actually have veto power. But in those instances where the mayor has veto power, the mayor does not vote. So when you're talking with your peers in other cities, it's one of the reasons why it's important to understand what form of government they have. I can use Kansas City as an example. Kansas City is a mayoral form of government. It's not a city manager form of government, although they do have a city manager. The mayor is a strong mayor. In the city of Columbia, the mayor does not have regular administrative duties, although I would imagine that he would probably disagree, because I know he's in the office a lot and has to carry out and provide advice on a regular basis. So while there are no regular administrative duties, there are certainly a lot of burdens that fall on the position, because it is the head of government for all legal and ceremonial purposes, and certainly is a position that's looked to because it's elected at large within the city. In the Columbia City Charter, we're going to talk about some of the provisions that relate directly to council members, and I'm going to highlight those that are specific to, as we used to call it, ways that you can lose your job. Section 12 is by far something that you need to be aware of. You shall not request or interfere with the appointment or removal of officers or employees. Except for the purpose of inquiry, council members shall deal with administrative officers and services solely through the city manager. City council members may not give orders to subordinates of the city manager, either publicly or privately. That is known in legal terms as the non-interference clause. Non-interference by council members in those day-to-day operations. It's important because the penalty is forfeiture of office. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go straight to forfeiting the office. So we don't have to deal with this on a regular basis. When we do deal with it, you usually first get a call from the city manager, or you get a call from me, or an email from me, or some kind of gentle reminder that we may have had a city employee who thought that they were receiving direction. And I think one of the most frustrating things as a newly elected council member is that you give up some of your citizen rights. Right? As a citizen, you could demand things out of city employees. Now, they wouldn't always listen, but as a council member, you cannot make that kind of demand. You can't even suggest that kind of a demand. It's off limits once you become elected. So council members lose some of their freedom of speech to engage in that kind of activity once you're elected as a council member, because you act now as a board or a group. It takes four council members for any particular action under our form of government, under our charter. Four affirmative votes are required for action. So the first thing when you go to the city manager and ask him to do something or tell him something you want, he may say to you, or he may not, depending upon what the circumstances are, but he may say, I don't see where there are four council members who want that to happen. So if you're out there on an island, you have to garner the support of your fellow council members in order to get something accomplished. Yes.
Can I ask you a question? Early in my career, I've served through several city managers, Ray Beck and several others, Mike Mathis, and it's my experience. Early on in my career, I had an unfortunate incident with the former mayor, Darwin Hyndman, when I was asked a question about giving my advice as to a hiring and firing. At that time, I think it was either it was with respect to water and light and so on. And frankly, the mayor put me on report with the city attorney for interfering with offering my opinion after I was asked it. I thought that was kind of a little strange, but nonetheless, that's what happened. And then there have been other city managers who have had a little more laissez-faire attitude towards this, that you can ask, not only can you ask for information, but you can express your opinion and so on. And then there are other city managers, and most notably the current city manager, and I respect his certainly his authority and his opinion with respect to, yes, you can talk to folks, but I'd like to know about it. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But how do you reconcile all of that in terms of how the city council is supposed to behave?
I think it's one of those situations where it's balance in all things. Some city managers are more comfortable seeking that advice and accepting that advice. Others are more straight down the line and don't want you talking to anyone. I believe that the current city manager allows council members to talk with and make inquiry of department heads. It's sometimes the level within the organization that becomes problematic, because most department heads are very comfortable talking with elected council members and having that conversation. And the farther down you go in the organization, the less comfort there is with that. The best practice is always to go through the city manager's office and to use the fellows specifically for that, because there's a system set up. What I think sometimes people in the organization become concerned when council members ask a question. You know, you can't, the charter says, except for purposes of inquiry, she'll deal with administrative officers solely through the city manager. That's not like playing Jeopardy, where you ask the where you make a statement in the form of a question. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes there are staff members who feel like when a question is asked, it's really not a question; it's more of a directive. You know, for example, if a council member were to say to an employee, "Don't you really think it would be better to paint those street signs green instead of orange?" You know, is that really a question, or is that right. A, I really think this should happen, and if you don't make it happen, I'm going to go talk to somebody else. So it's kind of that perspective. Charter section 156 is the conflict of interest part of the charter, and it says that no council member shall have any interest in any contract or sale to the city of any land, material, supplies, or services where said interest is in violation of the Constitution of the State of Missouri or ordinance of the city. We will talk a little bit more about the conflict of interest pieces in the state law. Important part, again, is that this is forfeiture from office. Both conflict of interest and non-interference are forfeiture of office actions that would actually have to be instituted if a council member doesn't voluntarily vacate this seat. It would be an action instituted either by the Attorney General or by the Missouri Ethics Commission. The Columbia City Charter also addresses campaign finance laws as a potential forfeiture of office. So council members are required to comply with state and local laws related to campaign practices and financing and conduct of campaigns for elective office. Again, that's subject to a separate action for removal. In that instance, it is a council action, and the council could declare the individual ineligible to seek elective municipal office for 2.5 years following a finding that provision of the charter has been violated. Nepotism, another way to lose your job. This one is a true do not pass go, do not collect $200, go straight to forfeiture of office. Nepotism is a prohibition of a public officer or employee by virtue of their office who appoints or employs a relative within the fourth degree of consanguinity or affinity. Affinity is marriage, consanguinity is blood. So there is no appointment of a relative within the fourth degree, and I'll, in a couple of slides, we'll walk through that. But there are some special considerations that you need to be aware of when it comes to nepotism. A husband is related by marriage, which is affinity to his wife's relatives, in the same way as consanguinity, which is the blood relationship. A half relationship is the same as a whole. A step relationship is the same as a blood relationship. A relationship by marriage terminates if there's a death or divorce. Employment is broadly interpreted. So cases have interpreted that employment includes retention of an attorney by a public administrator in her official capacity. So it can be a contractual arrangement, not necessarily an employee-employer relationship. Corporations are not relatives for purpose of nepotism. However, if it's a closely held corporation, I think the same rules related to retention of an attorney might apply when it comes to a closely held corporation. Appointment does not have to be a paid position. It applies to volunteers. So when you make your board and commission appointments at every meeting, you need to know who's in your family tree and who's, if you're married, a spouse's family tree, because those all apply, even though it's a volunteer position. Even if we have to beg somebody to take it, do not vote on appointment of that. Recuse yourself. It can be cured through recusal and stepping away. Fourth degree. What is fourth degree? Start in the upper left-hand corner with yourself or your spouse. And then if you go across the top, you count over and then you count down. You have to always find a common ancestor and then you go down. So your fourth degree would be your parent, your sibling, your niece or nephew, and then grandnieces and nephews. It's pretty far down there. Your first cousins are within the first degree of consanguinity or your spouse's first cousins. So yourself or spouse, you go to your parent, your grandparent, that's two, aunt and uncle is three, first cousin is four. If you're lucky enough to have your great-great-grandparents still alive, please do not vote on them for appointments to a board or commission. Same way with a great-great-grandchild.
Point their children.
Yeah. Okay. And I would go back. I'm going to go back to that just for a minute, because this actually applies not only to elected officials but also to appointed officials. So to the extent that department heads are listening and aware of this and making decisions, hiring decisions within the department, those decisions cannot be made within the fourth degree of consanguinity for self, spouse. Yes.
Just for example, the appropriate thing to do is to recuse yourself from not only the vote, but also the discussion of any determination of anybody who serves on a board and commission if you have some sort of relationship with that person.
That is correct. In the past, the Ethics Commission has recommended that you step away from the table. They don't require that. But I would advise you that it's in your best interest to fully recuse yourself, even from the room, so that there is no appearance of any kind of pressure put on your fellow council members. I know sometimes those decisions, and you're a perfect example of one. You have a spouse that serves on a board or commission, was serving on a board or commission before you actually were elected.
Interestingly, Board of Health.
So, Board of Health, exactly.
But
I've seen those votes happen so fast that you can't even get out of the room before the vote occurs. But
fortunately, the city clerk advised me that I had to clear out well before any discussions.
Types of decisions. So how and what you make decisions as an elected official really depends, and the basis upon which you make those decisions based upon the type of decision that's being made. There are two main types, and then we're going to talk about some nuances with those. But there are legislative decisions and administrative decisions. Legislative decisions are where the body is making the rules, and it's the one time when you're going to be presumed to be correct by the courts if there's a challenge. So as long as the rules that are made are not arbitrary and unreasonable, the decision will be upheld on a legislative action. Administrative actions, however, are those where you're faced with applying the rules. Now, I will say very few of the acts that come before the city council are administrative. Most of those are handled by the city manager and the city manager's staff. With the type of administrative action that does come to mind, though, is platting actions. Platting actions have been deemed in the state of Missouri to be administrative because they're an application of the rule and the rules that have previously been established in your zoning code or your subdivision code about how real estate should be laid out and parceled up for purposes of a plat. So if you don't like the rules need to be legislative changed, because when it comes to applying those rules to a plat, there is very little discretion. I know sometimes that can be frustrating to citizens when they don't want a subdivision to go in next to their property, but that's one of the unfortunate positions that you're put into as elected officials. And we've talked about that in the past, which is why are council members required, if it's an administrative decision, to make a decision on a plat, and it's required by state law. So
Are there not exceptions, however, for public safety and things like egress and ingress and those kinds of issues?
There are, but most of those have already been established in the code and the subdivision standards for where your streets are offset, how big they have to be, how far they have to be away from each other, you know, what that alignment is supposed to look like. In a plan development, when a plan development is coming forward, which is being done in conjunction with a plat or a preliminary plat, you have more discretionary authority because the very nature of a plan development is that there's some give and take. The rules that have been established for subdivision configuration are not being followed exactly according to the subdivision standards. And so when you start having that give and take, then you have more discretion that enters the process. So that comes down to, you know, when is a plat a discretionary act? When is it a ministerial act and a quasi-judicial act? Because those are the three types of actions that you're going to take. In addition to legislative and administrative, they fall underneath the discretionary, ministerial, and judicial types of acts. I'm not going to belabor the discretionary and ministerial again. What's more important at this point, I think, are the quasi-judicial. Most of those are going to be related to statutorily mandated public hearings. The core elements to a public hearing is that there is a notice and an opportunity to be heard. In Columbia, we allow public comment on all of our ordinances. That is not a public hearing procedures for a quasi-judicial act. That does not turn your legislative act into a quasi-judicial act requiring a public hearing. We refer to them as public hearings sometimes, but they're not really public hearings. Those are public comment opportunities before you make a legislative act. Your public hearings are those that are required by statute, primarily in land use decisions, before you enact a budget, anything that's statutorily required to be a public hearing. Those are your quasi-judicial actions. And those, for quasi-judicial actions, you have to be an impartial decision-making body. You can't come into those proceedings or those public hearings with your mind made up. Your decision has to be made on the facts. It can be made on the facts based upon the paperwork that's been provided in the council packet. It can be based upon the facts that's provided during that are provided during public testimony. In the case of land use hearings where the Planning Commission has previously held a public hearing that the council is relying upon, your decision may be based upon that. If you have had ex parte contacts from a developer or a member of the public related to a project and your decision is going to be made partially upon that ex parte conduct or that contact outside of the public hearing, that needs to be disclosed disclosed openly prior to the close of the public hearing, and the other party needs to have an opportunity to respond to that. So it's the fundamental fairness of notice and opportunity to be heard before you deal with someone's property rights. Yes.
Could you use your microphone?
In keeping with this idea, could you go back? I'm sorry. There we go. When we're talking about full disclosure of facts considered, so as elected officials, and if we have our office hours, we are lobbied by the general public on issues that of concern to them. And so if we disclose that we've had those conversations, is it also important to disclose the content of those conversations, as opposed to just saying I've had ex parte communications with not only the developer who came to see me in my office hours, but my neighbors, and then we talked about this? Or is it just sufficient to name that you've had these conversations?
If your decision is based upon those conversations, you should disclose at least those portions of the conversation upon which your decision is going to be based. Again, it's the idea of fundamental fairness that someone has an opportunity to respond to those mm-hmm. allegations. It has to be in order, if you get challenged on a quasi-judicial act, we have to rely upon the record that's created during the public hearing. And if those facts are not disclosed, we have no record upon which to support your decision. So it's important to get that information into the record. So yes, you do need to disclose it if your decision's based upon it.
Well, our decisions, wouldn't they always be based on our constituents?
Well, they are, but it has to be on the record, right? It has to be at the public okay. hearing. So if you've heard a repeat of everything that you had a conversation with a developer about, so sometimes I know developers like to come and meet with you
yes,
to
do.
Give you an opportunity to take a look at the plans and have an opportunity to ask questions. But to the extent that you're making a decision based on any of that material, it needs to be presented during the public hearing. Mm-hmm. Now, it can be presented by the developer, and it's okay to say, I had a conversation, but there isn't anything other than what was presented during the public hearing today that I'm going to have base my decision upon.
I think that there's going to be an awful lot of disclosure. I mean, because that's why I represent a ward, is because my neighbors in that ward want to talk to me about their concerns.
Well, if you want to base your decision upon what their concerns are, they need to come to the public hearing and actually put that onto the record.
Sure.
Because otherwise it doesn't become a basis for which you can make your decision, unfortunately.
Okay.
So, and they can have a neighborhood spokesperson. It needs to get into the public record.
And so if those things came in on emails or whatever that came through the city clerk's office, then those are things that have gotten in the record, but the public that attends the hearing can't see those.
It has to be admitted during the public hearing.
Admitted during the public hearing. Okay.
Correct.
Now, the things that have to do with notice and opportunity to be heard, are those only for the benefit of the applicant of whatever that decision is, or is it to the benefit of everyone that's aggrieved or affected by that?
It's to the benefit of everyone.
Okay.
Normally, you're dealing with the property rights of the landowner. Mm-hmm. So we have to be, super cautious about that. You're also dealing, though, with the property rights of neighbors and whether or not there is a basis for, if it's fear or if there's a basis within the city code to deny an action based upon what the neighbor's concerns are.
When we set parameters as to how far we give notice on land use decision-making, how is that tied into the city charter, and how is that decision made as to how that notice goes out?
Those time limits are set by state law.
No, distance, not time limits.
Oh, distance. There's a requirement under state law for that as well, for how far you go from where an applicant has made an application from the boundaries of that. That's set by state law. We can exceed that
okay.
by city charter. We cannot go less than that, than what state law provides. Gosh, I don't remember off the top of my head. I want to say it's
185,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. And is that something that has to be in the charter, or can change as at the consensus of council?
So that would be in the city code, not
okay.
in the charter.
Okay, thank you.
So that'd be in the UDC, Unified Development Code.
Thank you.
Generally, Nancy, it's sufficient to bring into evidence the suggestion that you've talked to somebody in particular and they are advocates or they are opponents of this particular thing. And generally speaking, if you're basing your argument on some of the issues that you have discussed, it will come out in discussion between the public hearing and the city council. That's sufficient, right?
That's correct. That's correct. What you don't want to do is base your decision on an allegation of noise that was never disclosed in the public record, and then later on you say, well, I didn't want that because it was going to be too noisy, and then no one had an opportunity to respond. So this slide particularly just covers ex parte communications and the need to disclose before the vote. So ethics and use of public resources. Your public funds are required to be used for public benefit. You can have incidental private benefit, but no charitable contributions. We don't just make charitable contributions are a private entity or a private corporation. They're a private endeavor. Cities can have contracts for services with charitable organizations to provide goods and services back to the municipality or to the citizens of the municipality, but we can't just write a check to the Boy Scouts for $100,000 without getting something in return. One of the things that we don't talk about a lot, unless it's campaign time, but it's a good time to mention it. You cannot use public funds to advocate, support, or oppose a ballot measure or candidate for public office. We will remind you of that if we end up with any ballot measures in the future that will be presented to the citizens. We always try to remind council before that comes out. You can do public appearances and press releases, but you should not be using city computers or city equipment if you've been issued any kind of city equipment. You should not use your city email account to advocate and support or opposition of any kind of ballot measure or even your own personal campaigns to the extent that may be communicating with constituents.
But Nancy, by way of an embarrassing disclosure, I learned that lesson very early. I think it was in 2007 when a former city councilman suggested to me that I should not be advertising a campaign on a computer that I was using while I was at work at the university, employed by the university. It's a clear-cut example of what you should not do, and I learned that lesson very early, which is one of the reasons why I don't have an iPad here. I have my own personal computer, but nonetheless, it illustrates some of the difficulties you can get into if you're not thinking about this.
Right, it's an easy mistake to make. Normally, if there's an easy mistake, the Ethics Commission will just have a discussion with you. They may enter into, they have consent orders that they enter into, but normally a one-time mistake is not going to be the end of a career, but it is something that you should be aware of because it could. And depending upon who the complainant is or the damages that are suffered by it and the extent of the misuse. But there are both state and federal laws. The Hatch Act on the federal side also applies to use of government equipment for political endeavors. ethics and personnel matters. City Council has three employees, and as we talked about earlier, there is a non-interference clause in the charter about all of the other employees of the city. The three employees of the council or the city manager, the city clerk, and the municipal judge. The municipal judge has a 4-year term of office, and that is for independent decision-making within that office. Your city manager has a contract, which also allows some independence of decision-making, but that particular contract does have a buyout, which gives council the opportunity to think twice before they terminate a city manager, and I think that's a wise move on anyone's part. You don't want to just, in essence, pull that trigger too quickly, and it causes the council to really consider whether or not that's an action that wants to be taken because of the contract. Unfortunately for the city clerk, there is no contract. But when you're pretty amazing, you don't need a contract. The sole exception to all of the other employees are the city councilor. And in my position, I am appointed by the city manager and confirmed by the city council. And I am also removed by the city manager with the advice and consent of the council. Again, to act as a kind of a checks and balances on the system, it leads me to be impartial and leads me to represent my loyalties and my allegiance is to the city as the corporate entity. It's not to any particular individual person. I certainly work for the city manager, but I work for all of the council members as well, if you make a request of me, and department heads, and from time to time employees that get involved in litigation, we also work for out of my office.
So is that right? It says removal is with advice and consent, but appointment is consent only?
Correct.
But what does advice mean?
Just confer in advance, I guess. I don't know that there is any substantive difference.
But I mean, is there any conflict with the earlier one about not being involved with personnel decisions?
Not when the charter provides for it. So the charter specifically allows this as an exception.
Okay.
This is not in the city code. It's actually in the charter.
Okay. And if we were to tell the city manager to fire you, would that be...
Oh, would that be a... Would that be a?
Our advice to him is to remove you.
I think it is his decision, but...
Okay.
You have to consent to it.
Right. Not that that
was. Is the way that. Now I'm starting to get more. Now I think the way I read the charter is that it's his decision, but he has to get your consent, mm-hmm. and vice versa when it comes to the appointment. You know, if you wanted to advise him in that regard, I don't think it would be a violation of the charter, though, on the non-interference.
There is a difference between advice and consent, however. I mean, you can offer your opinion and give that as advice, and that's not a vote.
Right. Council can't do the removal, but council could provide advice. Just one thing to note is that in the city councilor's office, we do not represent individual council members on matters of personal conflict of interest. So... we will provide you advice if there's a question about it. We will refer you to the Missouri Ethics Commission, and the Missouri Ethics Commission can walk you through that. But we will certainly give you our best opinion as we can. But at the end of the day, council members are responsible for determining whether or not they have a conflict of interest, because we don't know all of your personal circumstances or situations. But we will walk you through the decision-making process. I'm going to jump back to, this is where I said I got a little disjointed. I'm going to jump back to land use decisions. These slides are really, the next few slides are really exist primarily to give you the factors for your decision making on land use decisions. We talked earlier about how some of the decisions are discretionary, some are ministerial, and some are quasi-judicial. And so between those administrative and ministerial acts, which are the platting and the application of existing development code provisions, you have the legislative acts. And so all of the factors on which you decide the legislative acts are set forth in the next few slides. So on ethics and land use for annexation, your factors for determining whether or not an annexation is an appropriate measure to approve are whether the area to be annexed is contiguous and compact. You consider whether it's reasonable and necessary to proper development of the city, whether the city has the ability to furnish normal municipal services to the area to be annexed within a reasonable time. So those are the factors that you would consider for an annexation. For zoning, likewise, this sets forth all of the types of considerations for zoning. And I'm not going to read all of these. They are here for your information and use. But when you start when you start discussing a zoning matter that comes before the board, it's really helpful if we have to defend your action that you go back and review these factors, because if you speak about your either approval or denial of that action in these terms, then it's really helpful for us to be able to defend that. So like, for example, on a zoning action, if you don't believe that the particular zoning fits with the character of the neighborhood, then you can use these factors to justify your action, either in the positive or the negative. So, you know, too much traffic congestion, those kinds of factors. Zoning is a legislative action, and you have quite a bit of discretion in your zoning actions. Site plan review, same thing. These are the factors that you would want to consider for a site plan review. Plotting and subdivision, ministerial act, these are the limited things that you can take a look at when it comes to a plotting and subdivision. When it comes to exactions, it's a little more complicated. An exaction is a requirement where the city would require a developer to dedicate land to construct public improvements or make payments in lieu of fees for construction of public improvements. Our sidewalk fee in lieu thereof is a form of exaction. It's set forth in the code. It's a process we use. If a developer is not going to build a sidewalk, you can charge that fee in lieu of construction. In order to have an exaction or a lawful exaction, it needs to be a requirement that's actually imposed or exists in your existing city code. So it's important. You can't say to someone, I want you to put or install on top of a building downtown a wind, turbine. Thank you. I want to call a windmill. You can't require construction of a wind turbine on top of a building if it's not including your city code. Now, if we make it a part of the zoning code or the city code as a development requirement, then yes, you could get that exaction, but you just can't decide individually that something's a good idea and make that happen. Collectively, there have to be at least four council members who believe that that exaction is appropriate, and it needs to be in the city code already in the UDC before you use it as a basis for making your decision.
So that can't be emphasized enough. If it's an exaction, it has to be codified. If it's a negotiation, that's a different, an entirely different ballgame. And frankly, the UDC was in an attempt to eliminate some of the negotiation that went on in the past.
That's correct. And it has to be reasonably related to the development. There are a lot of factors that go into the relationship between an exaction and that particular development. But you're exactly right. That's the case when it comes to that that type of an exaction. So if the council as a whole decides to include some type of exaction in the city code, then it's something that can be applied. The only exception is if it's a planned development and your developer is asking for a lesser setback, you can require greater landscaping. You can begin that negotiation or give and take that may be appropriate for what the citizens are giving up under the existing zoning code. I'm just going to hit real quickly because I don't want to run out of time. I am going to run out of time. I know she knows how many slides I've got.
Move on, though.
So as a governmental entity, you can only act in an official meeting. Any actions outside of that official meeting don't bind the municipality. Under our charter, Section 14 says no action by council has legal effect unless it takes place at a meeting open to the public. This city council, while you may gain consensus in closed session, does not vote in closed session. It votes in open session as a requirement of the city charter. And it takes four positive votes. It's not a majority of those who are present at a meeting. It's four affirmative votes for even a motion by the city council. Sunshine Law. We could do hours on Sunshine Law. It's in the materials.
Yeah.
But in essence, even though you are a majority of the public governmental body who is meeting or happens to be gathered at the same location, as long as you're not talking public business, it's not a violation of the Sunshine Law. You can talk Chiefs football all day long. You can talk Cardinals baseball. You can have dinner and drinks as long as you don't talk city business. If it is going to be, and this is where it gets complicated when it comes to electronic meetings, because a meeting can be held electronically, but the minute you have a majority of council there, you have to have had the date, time, place, tentative agenda posted 24 hours in advance, and then it has to be accessible to the public. And we in Columbia are required to have ADA accessibility for any meeting that's conducted. So it's not a simple, let's just turn on Zoom and start having a meeting. There are specific laws related to holding of public office that you should be aware of. Those laws weren't applicable to you before you got elected, Ms. Fowler, I'm sorry. In general, under the conflict of interest laws, you are prohibited from participating directly or indirectly in an action that would be a financial gain to yourself, your spouse, or your dependent children. The requirement is that you have to affirmatively report it, and there is a penalty for failure to do that. We also have a form that is filled out in the city hall before you vote. If you have a conflict of interest and you desire to abstain from a conflict of interest, the city clerk has a form that should be filled out before the vote, and you have to get permission of the remainder of council. In the city of Columbia, there is an affirmative duty to vote, which means you don't get the opportunity to abstain just because it is an uncomfortable vote to make. You have to vote unless you get the consensus of the remainder of council, and you have to request that permission. And that's done at the beginning of the meeting, I think during the approval and adjustment of the agenda, or just thereafter. I'm not going to go through all of the details when it comes to conflict of interest laws. A dependent child, though, is a child who's under the 18 years of age and resides in your household. So if you have a 24-year-old residing in your household who's your child, they are not a dependent child under the statute, even though they may receive more than 50% of their support from you. You are prohibited from using...
Steve, Sapp, could you close those doors, please? Thanks. Sorry.
You may not use confidential information that has been gained in your official capacity for your personal benefit to yourself, spouse, or dependent children or business with which you're associated. You also may not disclose it. So those are really two separate concepts that are understood in the law. One is using, one is disclosing. So you can't give it to someone else for their benefit or for the benefit of a third party, where that third party has a financial gain. Confidential information is information that's not a matter of public record or knowledge, and usually is something that's transmitted orally or in writing. It's really... we're a very transparent form of government, so you actually receive very limited knowledge of things that are confidential, but you do from time to time. And until you have heard it from a public source, you're required not to disclose or discuss it.
And just a note, those are usually like personnel matters or real estate matters, those kinds of issues, right?
Correct. Or it could be a contract that's coming forward, or an opportunity, an RFP, things like that, where there might be some special knowledge that's gained by being a member of council that's not open to the general public. Maybe where a project's going to go. we get asked this question quite a bit, which is, what is a special monetary benefit? And that's when you are affected in a substantially different manner than the general public or class of individuals. So just because something is happening in your neighborhood doesn't necessarily mean that it is going to be a substantial or special monetary benefit to you, or it's close to you. You have to be affected in a substantially different manner than the rest of the public. Okay, so then misuse of public position is set forth in the conflict of interest statutes as well, and that's where you act or refrain from acting by reason of payment or payment or receipt of anything of pecuniary value to yourself or any third person. This does not mean that you as an individual have to receive the monetary benefit. It can be a benefit to any third person. That includes organizations and companies as well. And it will also include, and I think a lot of people get confused by this, it includes gifts or campaign contributions made by performance of an official act. Certainly people who are making your campaign contributions are people with whom you're familiar. They're people who are going to be your advisors many times, but it cannot be a quid pro quo contribution in exchange for an act. Same thing when it comes to political appointments. As an elected official, you're required to file your personal financial disclosure statements. One of the things you should be aware of is if you serve on a board or commission for another agency, or a board of directors, I shouldn't say board or commission, a board of directors for another agency, that's the type of thing you would want to consider disclosing on your personal financial disclosure statement. Because serving on the board of directors does give you a business, it defines it as part of a definition of a business with which you are associated. Okay, and
got about three more minutes.
This is your substantial interest, is your 10% more of a business or having a value of more than $10,000.
So we as a council have adopted the short form of that personal financial disclosure. What time of year do we consider adopting the long form? Is that every year or every 2 years?
Every 2 years.
You want to? Is there?
Actually, we
been doing every year.
We do it every year, I think, just to cover our bases.
Make sure that we don't miss a deadline.
Yeah, filed every year.
And it's coming up, I think, in August or something.
That sounds right.
It seems
so
like
you want to consider going to the long form?
Well, I started to fill out the long form by mistake one time, and I was informed by the Missouri Ethics Commission not to do that, to use the short form. So I don't know whether they make that decision or is that something we make.
We adopt that as our policy.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Okay, and the last thing I'm going to hit is incompatibility of office. A couple things, but incompatibility of office is another way that you can forfeit your office, because if you do become elected to a second office, you may become elected to a second office, but only if it is compatible. There are four factors to determine whether or not a second office is compatible. They're on the screen. But the acceptance of the second office actually serves as a resignation of the first under the law. So the latest elected office, if the offices are incompatible, would in fact leave you with only one office. It doesn't apply where one position is employment, though, and the other is a public office. An example of an incompatibility would be as if you're the city clerk and the collector, or the mayor and the presiding commissioner, deputy sheriff and a police judge. You know, just doesn't, those are things where clearly you have a conflict of interest. All complaints are made in writing to the Missouri Ethics Commission. And the only other thing I'd say is that there are protections for complainants. So if somebody does make a complaint or an ethics complaint, there are protections for the complainant, and there can be no discrimination or discharge of an employee who is reported as a suspected violation. With that, do you have any questions?
Any questions?
More than happy to advise you if you have any.
Thank you. Did you make it through your slides, or are there other?
Good.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. We do need to take a hard break before the 7 o'clock, and we'll be back in a couple minutes. And the microphones may still be.